Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And folks, if you don't want to see your kids picking up guns, and I mean guns because we're literally under fire, where things are getting just chaotic, where, you know, we actually start bringing troops into your communities, then maybe one of the things you can do is actually get actively involved by praying. That's why we keep on saying learn, pray, act. So there are prayer circles, and go to Reclaiming the Republic, the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. We got a prayer circle that you can get active in if you want to do something before it gets worse. Now, it's all about compliance of the Constitution, which begs this conversation, because I don't want to necessarily, you know, spend a lot of time on the the ephemeral or temporary things of the day. But welcome back, Sean. And I just wanted to have a kind of a quick conversation, because this kind of goes in line with the Veterans Day, you know, honoring those who've worn the uniform, have gone out and defended and or, you know, fought to preserve liberty in some way or another. And the fact is, we're starting to see government making decisions that are empowering people that are the process is not constitutional. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so when we look at what is happening, in this particular case, Congress has given the president the discretion to use the militia, or the National Guard, deploy the National Guard into cities where he considers an insurrection out of hand. Well, the Constitution only gave that power to Congress to call forth the militia for those purposes. In other words, it's our representatives, not, you know, some tyrant that has that discretion. This should not be happening this way. The whole point of this, folks, is checks and balances. Now, there's a lot of MAGA, there's a lot of Trump sycophants that are out there that, oh yeah, I don't have a problem with this. But guess what? Trump's not going to be in office forever. And when they set policies like this, when they bend or violate the Constitution, go around the Constitution, they end up maintaining these same policies. Do you want Obama or the next Biden to actually start deploying forces? What do you think?
I think that we have a very serious problem in the country with the crime and illegal immigrants. And somebody's got to do something about it. I mean, we can't just allow these blue city leaders to just keep enacting this cloud pivot agenda that they have to destroy everything and create chaos so that they have an excuse to take further power and authority.
Yeah, so I'm not arguing against acting. I'm arguing against acting unconstitutionally. In other words, whether we like it or not, Congress needs to make the ultimate decision that we need to actually start enforcing the Constitution. And so Congress, you know, we got a Congress right now that is actually willing to do the job, because they just gave the president the full discretion of doing whatever he wanted to do. Well, why couldn't they just say, okay, instead of giving you unconstitutional powers, we're just going to exercise our power so that you can have the power necessary to do what you want to do? That makes more sense to me than tearing down a wall so that the next president can get away with exercising tyrannical powers, because Congress already granted the discretion to the president. It's kind of like where we see a lot of people complain when the president uses military force over, you know, when they think that there's an interest or there is, and we're going to get into this when we get into the Whiskey Rebellion, because this is the heart. This is the heart of what the process is. The representatives of the people are to decide whether they're going to call up the people that voted them into office into a federal service of creating a federal army and actually picking up their guns and going and exercising deadly force against American people. It is the reason it's in their hands is because that the it's a check and balance of, you know, we didn't like the fact that you did this to us. We're not doing this. When you give it to the president, then it's not necessarily representative. And it actually is kind of like the pilot washing his hands to say, well, I'm not really doing it. We're just empowering the tyrant to do it. There's a lot of wisdom in the process, and using the process the way it was designed, to me, is really, really critical. And so we're seeing these types of things, and it just bothers me, because on the heels of what we were talking about regarding patriots getting involved, I would rather see the actual states doing their job. But what we have to do, and what I would rather see, actually, because you actually hit the nail on the head when you talk about the Cloward Piven, you know, agenda being pushed by all of these politicians in the state and cities and so forth, right?
Correct.
Do
J.B. Pritzker, Newsom,
Ferguson, yeah. Ferguson, and what is it, Brown, the turd that won't flush?
Right.
Anyway, forgive me for saying that. So the point is that actually these people who are using these tactics, these people who are actually failing to enforce the rule of law and failing to actually repel these invaders, why isn't Trump actually holding them accountable to their oath of office and removing them? Instead, he's stepping over them and doing something that is not necessary. I honestly would rather see the states utilizing their militia force, giving back the National Guard and the National Air, what have you, back to the states and say, look, you need to do this, and if you don't do this, we will come in. But you have more than enough force to do this and start removing people for failing to do their job. Because remember, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment makes it so easy. This is, you know, the reason why people don't, they're so apprehensive in pulling the trigger on this is because, boy, it's not going to stop. We're going to get rid of a lot of bad characters. A lot. Because now all of a sudden people see, wow, that was great. In other words, we see people currently serving. We see people currently, you know, hiding because we're waiting for the lawyers to build up enough case to drag them into court to then hopefully get justice so that we can remove them from office. When the Constitution already gives us the mechanism of removing them from office, now if you want to actually try them for the crimes and everything else, by all means, you should do that. But why are we having to continue to suffer under their rule of tyranny? That somebody needs to explain to me. Because it sure as I can see this, our problems go away a lot faster when we actually remove the people that are actually causing the problem upstream. These governors, these mayors, these folks that you're pointing to. Right? I mean, it's insane to deal with the problem at the river level. I mean, you're just trying to get the sewage out of the river instead of going up and actually plugging the sewage plant. Anyway, it's this, because I know you probably haven't listened to my show for a long, long time, but I used to talk about, you know, when we're examining the problem, you know, we're looking at the river and we're seeing the sewage in the river and whatever. Oh, we got to clean the river up. Nobody ever thinks about going upstream and what is the cause of this? Because, I mean, when we know it's a sewage plant, but now it's really ambiguous because what's causing the sewage of our society? This is a metaphor. And actually, the number one contributors to the sewage in our society is the education system. But instead, you know, we're creating systems of getting kids off fentanyl and getting people, you know, off drugs and off, but it's failing. And creating homeless, you know, support systems, all of these types of things are failing because we're not really solving the problem. And it's kind of like, it even goes to that metaphor of talking about the elephant in the room. You know, if we're not adult enough to actually talk and identify what the real problems are, then, you know, you don't deserve to be in office. But that's my opinion. That's, you know, that's how I think. Anyway. All right. So I appreciate your two cents on that. Anything else you wanted to add? I mean, I value your input.
No, I just think that you're exactly right. And I think your methods for taking back the counties, I think, is the only opportunity we have to fix it, because these people have entrenched themselves with power and the corruption and their ability to dole out corruption as leverage is what the problem is. I mean, I could give you examples here in our own community where we had money from the federal government that was supposed to build our levees, and they put the money in some account or somewhere and didn't spend it to fix the levees, and then everybody's houses flooded the next time a hurricane came.
Right.
And what are we supposed to do? Take them to court and sue the parish? Well, who's going to pay for that? We are.
Right.
So unless you get rid of the people who actually have their hands on the levers that control the corruption and all these ridiculous programs that enrich people, because that's how they keep their power, is they give out these benefits to these people in order to keep them on their side so they can increase their power.
Right.
And I know down here in my area, we have generational entitlement.
Yep.
It's a lifestyle, you know, and that's why when they say, oh, the government shut down and your SNAP's getting cut off, everybody freaks out, because for the last three generations, their family has survived on these entitlements. Mm-hmm. And their children have been dumbed down in the schools. So now we have a bunch of zombies just looking for a government check.
Right. And so,
and we need to get back to the point where they're treated and learn a self-respect as an image holder of God, so that they can go out and do something with their life without being told, oh, no, we got you, we're going to take care of you.
Right.
Until we decide not to.
Right. And so actually, it's sad when money starts getting involved coming from government. What ends up happening is ways to basically obviate or obfuscate what that money's for, who's getting it, because, you know, we're pocketing all this money all the time, because you're talking about your levy system. There was a lot of money getting pocketed, right? The money was to update and continue to, you know, refurbish and reinforce these levees to be able to withstand, you know, the upcoming storm. But, oh, well, shoot, we haven't had a storm. Look at all, and how much money, did they ever find out how much money was poured in for the updates of these levees that never got updated? And just, what was the tune of the walk-away money that came in that never got applied? Anybody ever figure that out?
I tell you, billions. Billions. And okay. In our area,
yeah,
we have no levy. It's not an update or an upgrade. We have no levy along the lake. And all the other parishes around us have built levees. So when the tidal surge comes in, it's like a funnel. It goes along the other levees until it gets to the gap, and zoom, comes straight in.
Right. Now you talk about Lake Pontchartrain, right? That lake.
Correct.
Okay, yeah.
Correct,
so,
yeah.
Anyway.
Between the river and the lake, that's where we live.
Right. And considering, you know, your elevation, I think, you know, I can't understand why people haven't, you know, if the money was there, why didn't they do it? You know, anyway, I even back up and say, I look at it this way. A long, long time ago, people decided to live there at, you know, ignoring the consequences of living there. Now, granted, empirical data takes time to gather, right? I mean, you know, it may have taken 50, 100 years before people realize the real danger of living in, you know, this low elevation land and so forth. And so you would think that you know, if you're going to live there, you either live in a cardboard box because it doesn't cost you anything to rebuild, or when a storm comes, you know, you have a hunker in place, or you have a plan just to stay alive and not lose what little property you do have, so that, you know, you can get your cardboard boxes back from the grocery store to build your next house, so that you can exist. But there are consequences to where you go, where you live, and so forth. And we were actually talking about this in a meeting earlier today out of Missouri, where, because they live in Tornado Alley. And, you know, people that go to live in Missouri, you know, there are indications when you decide to move somewhere, because you may not have the empirical data that help you understand the consequences to your choice of living in this house. One of those things is that you actually are going to have your loan holder, you know, your lien holder, whoever's giving you the money to buy this house, you know, to help finance you to moving in there. They are telling you that you're going to have to go get very specific insurance, because the regular insurance companies do not provide, tornado insurance for homes in this area. That right there should be a red flag telling you that there are consequences to this decision you're making.
Right.
And so you may want to look at that home and go, well, this home does not look like a very fit home to withstand an F1 tornado let alone an F5. And so, I mean, you know, F5s don't happen all the time, but F1s sure do. And, you know, what would the level or intensity of the hurricane, or not hurricane, but the tornado, actually tornadoes are spawned from hurricanes as well, as you know. But nevertheless, you have to start thinking, you have to understand what the consequences are, because anybody that moves in and goes, well, you know, I expect the federal government to rebuild me, they don't have the authority to do that. They have no authority to, you know, come out and open their bowels and be compassionate in basically removing the consequences of dumb mistakes or decisions you've made. Government is not. We did not have and or create a government. Our forefathers didn't create a government that was designed to remove the consequences of our stupidity.
And the sad part about it is that they actually don't come here with compassion to help people. They come here and they see it as an opportunity, like Rahm Emanuel used to say, never let a good crisis go to waste.
That's right.
And what he meant by that was never let an opportunity to get more power by taking advantage of and leveraging a crisis.
Right.
And that's what they do. When a hurricane hits and they come down here with FEMA, they're acting like they're going to pass out money and do all these things. But what they really is buying off more of your sovereignty and liberty through funneling money and giving money to all these politicians on the local level and the state level and telling them, okay, I'm going to give you all this money, but you got to do this. And that's how it works.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's get back to the content. I appreciate this divergence, but the content that we're covering right now, which we just kind of left off with Tammy, is the Funding Act of 1790. This is an elaborate scheme by Alexander Hamilton in basically sharing the wealth of debt for everybody, so that everybody could be and participate in the ability in making money. You're going to see how that kind of, you know, comes forth. We already covered, if I remember correctly, did we get to Section 3? Did we get through Section 3?
I believe we did.
Okay. All right. Because I'm looking at it, and I'm not sure if we actually got into that. So let me just go ahead and read that, and then I'll have you pick up with 4 and on. But let me go ahead and just review this. Be it therefore further enacted that a loan to the full amount of the said domestic debt be, and the same is hereby proposed, and that books for receiving subscriptions to the said loan be opened at the Treasury of the United States and by a commissioner to be appointed in each of the said states on the first date of October next, to continue open until the last day of September following exclusively, and that the sums which shall be subscribed thereto be payable in certificates issued for the said debt according to the specie value and computing the interest upon such as bear interest to the last day of December next inclusively, which said certificates shall be of these several descriptions to wit. And then they go through. Do you remember any of this being read? Probably not. I don't remember any of this being read. So it's worth going through this. Okay, so what just was stated, folks, is a product that this national bank was going to operate outside of the Treasury. Now, I don't know if there is some akin or any association relationship to a private entity, because I haven't seen any of that here. But it basically says that there will be a book, you know, established at the Treasury, and there's going to be a commissioner in each state. And so now they're going to go down these, you know, some of the statuses. We're going to skip over 4 and 5. I think we're going to pick up again. Sean, you'll actually pick up on 5. We're going to just skip 4. But let me just go through this to get us to that. Those issued by the Register of the Treasury, those issued by the commissioners of loans in the several states, including certificates given pursuant to the Act of Congress of the 2nd of January, 1779, that's the Continental Congress, for bills of credit of the several emissions of the 20th of May, 1777, and the 11th of April, 1778. So what they're doing is they're basically bringing forward the debt from the Revolutionary War and Continental Congress on the Articles of Confederation. Then, let me continue. Those issued by the commissioners for the adjustment of the accounts of the quartermaster, commissary, hospital, clothing, and marine departments, those issued by commissioners for the payment or for the adjustment of accounts in the respective states, those issued by the late and present paymaster general or commissioner of army accounts, those issued for the payment of interest commonly called indents of interest, and in the bills of credit issued by the authority of the United States in Congress assembled at the rate of $100 in the said bills for $1 in specie. Now, they're basically laying out this, you know, this scheme of they're going to start printing these bills, and you're going to find that these are just like bonds. People are going to buy these bills, and over time, these bills will accrue interest and pay the person holding them. How is that a necessary and proper function of paying the debt?
It's not.
There you go. What this was a scheme, and we were kind of talking about this. To me, I see this as a scheme that if President Adams was in charge of the nation at the time when the bank went bankrupt, because it was basically broiling and broiling to where, you know, everything was going crazy, people were making money left and right, and then it collapsed. Because all, you know, and whether that collapse was external or internal, regardless, it collapsed, and whether it was, you know, by design of time, it doesn't matter. It collapsed. And what ended up happening is John Adams lost everything. John Adams was forced to move into the home of John Quincy Adams, his son, for a long period of time because he lost everything because he was that heavily invested. The President of the United States was that heavily invested. And so we will be back to talk more about this act. But the ramifications of what they were doing, I see this as a scheme, but we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now let me get us down to Section 5. We're going to just kind of skip over principles, interests, and that type of stuff. And folks, I really hate boring you, because I know how many of you really read through your mortgage, your car loan, you know, these documents of loans and how they're amortizing your interest. Technically, as we look back in those days, the framers actually looked at banks that were charging 5%, 3% interest was kind of, that was the limit. You were getting close to usury when you started exceeding that. And one of the things you'll notice that it actually talks about is they're talking about bearing an interest of 6% per annum. That's what they're paying out. So what they're collecting as far as, and who knows what the debt is by the other nations of what they put into those, but they needed to make sure that there was an aggressive payout to entice people to buy these products, to buy these bonds, what have you. So, as I laid this out, I believe if John Adams would have been at the helm of the bank failing, I think his reaction would have been a lot different than Thomas Jefferson. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why Thomas Jefferson just basically said, okay, we're closing the bank, we're moving the debt that we owe, we're no longer going to be, all these Americans that bought these bonds lost everything. And to be clear, Jefferson was up front telling everybody that this was unconstitutional. Buyer beware. So when it came time to for people to, you know, hey, I at least get this much money for my dollar, right? No. People lost everything. And that's when I think Jefferson just basically took, okay, we're going to take this legitimate debt. All this other crap's just crap. We took the legitimate debt, and they started paying that off. And that's, they simplified the Treasury getting rid of that banking system. I believe that when you look at what Madison did, I do not believe you see any artistic license of what Hamilton was doing in this first charter, if you know what I mean. So let's go ahead and read, and I think it was a godsend, because I think a lot of people felt that Adams, I mean, every president was going to do two terms. The fact that we actually had the second president unseated in his after his first term was kind of a real surprise, if that makes sense. So let's go ahead and pick up with Section 5.
And it further be it further enacted that for the whole or any part of any sum subscribed to the said loan by any person or persons or body politic, which shall be paid in the interest of the said domestic debt, computed to the said last day of December next, or in the said certificates issued in payment of interest commonly called indents of interest, the subscriber or subscribers shall be entitled to a certificate purporting that the United States owe to the holder or holders thereof his, her, or their assigns a sum to be specified therein equal to that by him, her, or them so paid, bearing an interest of 3% per annum, payable quarter, yearly, and subject to the redemption by payment of the sum specified therein. Okay. Whenever provision shall be made by law for that purpose.
Okay, I'm sorry. I prematurely interrupted you. So I want to make note of something. How many times have we heard people say that women were excluded in banking until 1970s? That they couldn't get a loan. They couldn't, you know, indulge in banking interest or what have you. Do you see the mention of his, her, him, her, and so forth? In other words,
absolutely,
the federal government was not being, biased in who could buy these products and who would be entitled to the interest payouts and so forth. And I find it interesting that maybe sexism, became prevalent in America over time, just like racism became prevalent in America over time. But it only became prevalent because somebody realized it was a way to divide and conquer us. Every time you see people come along and try to, compete with this cockamamie idea, we're going to do this, let's go do this because this is more important than everything else you're doing, that's only to get people to chase, it's, again, they try to chase people's passions. If there's enough people that want to save babies' lives, then they can actually get people to focus on that instead of actually getting government out of the business of doing things they have no authority to do. And one of those things being killing babies.
Section 6, and it be it further enacted that a commissioner be appointed for each state to reside therein, whose duty it shall be to superintend the subscriptions to the said loan, to open books for the same, to receive the certificates which shall be presented in payment thereof, to liquidate the specie value of such of them as shall not have been taken before liquidated, to issue the certificates above mentioned in lieu thereof, according to the terms of each subscription, to enter in books to be kept, be by him kept for that purpose, credits to the respective subscribers to the said loan for the sums to which they shall be respectively entitled, to transfer the said credits upon the said books from time to time as shall be requisite, to pay the interest thereupon as the same shall become due, and generally to observe and perform such directions and regulations as shall be prescribed by him, to him by the Secretary of the Treasury, touching the execution of his office.
Okay. All right. So there you go. So they're trying to make it so that this entices everybody to actually pay off the debt. Right? Because why are you buying these bonds? Well, you're paying the federal government money to... So show me... Show me in the Constitution where the federal government has the ability to appeal to the people to give them money so that they can pay their debts. It actually is very clear. They have the ability to direct tax, which is a duty, which that duty is placed upon an apportionment to each state based on the population. So in other words, you come out with, okay, we need this much money, and you divide that money by all of the heads in America, it, being whatever, 9 million something, and then you divide, that to come to a number per head, and then you go to each state based on the census to say, your state at the last census had this many people, we're basically levying this, direct tax, this duty upon you to pay this amount for this many, because that's this much per head. And so they basically lay out the direct tax that goes straight out to the states, and the states pay them. Now, there's also the impost, the taxes on foreign goods coming in. Now, there's also taxes on the excise taxes. Why did anybody think that this was okay, that the federal government could actually take your money and then use that money to pay you back for, you know, being a good patriot by buying a bond so that you could help pay the debt? This happened, you know, after World War II. If I remember correctly, I remember the war bonds as a kid. You could still buy bonds to this day. Why? That's not a power given to the government. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's crazy to even think about what they're talking about, how they're going to put somebody in every state to sell theirs. It's like the lottery before the lottery.
Yes. And actually, if you look at it, they're employing people to be a part of the scheme at the expense of the taxpayers.
Right.
Okay. So the Assumption Act, in every which way we looked at it, Madison was actually against this. Remember that Madison basically, as you read out of Jefferson's account, Madison wasn't going to vote for it, and he wasn't going to stop his objections to it, but he wasn't just going to be as vigorous in his objections anymore. He was basically going to tone it down a little bit. So everything moved forward, and all of these representatives in Congress had this opportunity to dive in and read, or I should say decide, on whether they're going to allow this assumption of this debt to go this way, instead of making it very forthright of saying, this is all the debt we owe, and this is how we're going to pay it off, period. Because I get it. Each debt, each contract with Holland, with France, what have you, inside that contract, it stipulated the amount of insurance that would be paid every year that you're servicing that debt, that they have to service the debt. In other words, collecting. So why not just be forthright? Because this kind of scheme was costing us money. That makes sense, right? I mean, you know, it's far more efficient to actually take the money and put less of a burden on the people. Just take the revenue money and pay the debt. If you need to, increase the duty tax or increase excise taxes. And, of course, we know people are going to be upset with that. And when people look at this scheme, this game, nobody's upset with it. Until it goes bankrupt. And then those people, only those people that invested heavily, you know, the more heavily invested you are, you know, the more upset you become because you want your money back. Anyway, let's go ahead and go through the next section.
Also, I think it's probably human nature for the people that maybe weren't involved in it or weren't benefited from it. They were saying to themselves, well, if they're going to be able to do this, then maybe I can think of my own scheme to use the government to get money. So I'll vote for this, and then later on, I'll get them to vote for my scheme.
Yes. The what we would call the slow ratcheting of more bad laws, more bad behavior by government. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So,
be it further enacted, mm-hmm, that the stock which shall be created pursuant to this act shall be transferable only on the books of the Treasury or of the said commissioners respectively, upon which the credit for the same shall exist at the time of the transfer by the proprietor or proprietors of such stock, his, her, or their attorney. But it shall be lawful for the Secretary of the Treasury by special warrant under his hand and the seal of the Treasury, countersigned by the comptroller and registered by the register at the request of the respective proprietors, to authorize the transfer of such stock from the books of one commissioner to those of another commissioner, or to those of the Treasury and from those of the Treasury to those of a commissioner.
Okay. Let's skip down to section 11. Now, folks, I'm dragging a dead horse here because we're reading all of this content. And everybody knows that they're literally assuming powers not granted. And they're doing things that is, you know, so reckless that, you know, I just... And interestingly enough, this was not enough for Jefferson and Madison to go to the states to interpose, to seek, you know, the states actually taking measures to step in. Now, keep in mind, Washington was the president of the United States. Nobody wanted to sully that man's career. There was that profound respect for that man and what he did. And so Congress is off doing this. The actual, you know, the check and balance, Washington should have actually vetoed this act and said, I'm not going to let you do this. But he didn't. Because he had an allegiance or an, what's the best way? He had a bad blind faith in Alexander Hamilton that ended up biting him. Actually, it bit him, but I don't think he realized it until much later, where he finally got to a point where he basically said, you know, you're not good. You're dragging us down. You're making us look bad, kind of thing. And that all happened around the time when Alexander Hamilton was outed for his adulterous affair while he was in the Treasury. I believe that's about that point in time. I don't believe that was later. I think that it was still Washington, under Washington's administration, and just shortly after, Jefferson just left office. Jefferson stepped down. He said, I'm not going to butt heads with this idiot anymore, Hamilton. Anyway, let's go ahead and dive into Section 11.
And be it further enacted that the commissioners who shall be appointed pursuant to this act shall respectively be entitled to the following yearly salaries. That is to say, the commissioner for the state of New Hampshire, $650. The commissioner for the state of Massachusetts, $1,500. The commissioner for the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantation, $600. The commissioner for the state of Connecticut, $1,000. The commissioner for the state of New York, $1,500. The commissioner for the state of New Jersey, $700. The commissioner for the state of Pennsylvania, $1,500. Commissioner for the state of Delaware, $600. The commissioner for the state of Maryland, $1,000. Commissioner for the state of Virginia, $1,500. The commissioner for the state of North Carolina, $1,000. The commissioner for the state of South Carolina, $1,000. And the commissioner for the state of Georgia, $700, which salary shall be in full compensation for all services and expenses.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, and back then, for sure.
And you notice that based on the size of the state was determining what your salary was going to be. Interesting, right? Okay, so
yes,
let's
it is.
So now let's go into Section 13. Because now we're going to see some of the duties and the amounts and sums and so forth. So let's go ahead and pick up 13, and we will kind of end with 13. Go ahead.
Be it therefore further enacted that a loan be proposed to the amount of $21,500,000 and that subscriptions to the said loan be received at the same times and places and by the same persons as in respect to the loan herein before proposed concerning the domestic debt of the United States, and that the sums which shall be subscribed to the said loan shall be payable in the principal and interest of the certificates or notes which prior to the first day of January last were issued by their respective states as acknowledgments or evidences of debts by them respectively owing, except certificates issued by the commissioners of army accounts in the state of North Carolina in the year 1786, provided that no greater sum shall be received in a certificate of any state than as follows, That is to say, in those of New Hampshire, $300. In those of Massachusetts, $4 million. In those of Rhode Island and Providence plantations, $200,000. In those of Connecticut, $1,600,000. In those of New York, $1,200,000. In those of New Jersey, $800,000. In those of Pennsylvania, $2,200,000. In those of Delaware, $200,000. In those of Maryland, $800,000. In those of Virginia, $3,500,000. In those of North Carolina, $2,400,000. In those of South Carolina, $4 million. In those of Georgia, $300,000. And provided that no such certificate shall be received, which from the tenor thereof or from any public record, act, or document shall appear or can be ascertained to have been issued for any purpose other than compensations and expenditures for services or supplies towards the prosecution of the late war and the defense of the United States or of some part thereof during the same.
Okay. So now you look at the amount that they were paying out to the states. What was the top haul? What state received the most amount?
And you're Virginia, gonna, huh?
No, not Virginia. South Carolina or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
South Carolina got $4
million. Mm-hmm. Virginia, yeah. $3 million. Right?
Yeah.
And so...
And Massachusetts, $4
million. Yes. And so, interestingly enough, I think the point is this, is that the salaries was not directly tied to the amounts being coming in. Because if you really looked at $300,000 compared to $4 million, that's a huge difference. Huge difference to where we go back up to the salaries of, let's look at New Hampshire and Massachusetts, right? And so the New Hampshire, $650, Massachusetts, $1,500, which is tantamount to about half, 50% difference. Now, when you look at the money being poured in, New Hampshire, $300,000 and $4 million, I mean, that's multiple fold, right? I mean, wow.
Yeah, and, big difference.
Right, and I don't know. I don't understand why they did what they did other than I think they were overpaying these commissioners just because they needed to have a quality of a person to ensure that that person was being paid well enough to actually stay there to do the job for a good duration of time. I mean, usually people don't walk away from a really good paying job, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. So the real point here is that here the federal government basically co-opted the states into taking unconstitutional money and playing in the scheme. Now, when we look at the states that had the biggest problems of the debt themselves, not paying the war debt and so forth, Massachusetts was one of those states. They got $4 million. Virginia, actually paying off their debt, got $3 million. So, again, I have a hard time understanding, other than being, you know, going through the entire process of the details of this dirty deed that Hamilton created. The fact of the matter is it's a dirty deed. Fact of the matter is that what they were doing was unconstitutional, and that when we look at the federal government, it should be, so we're supposed to have a gold and silver currency. Now, I don't think that you can buy clothes that could adequately, and I don't think most people, you know, if you're making that kind of money and you have that kind of wealth, I don't think you want to have to wear clothes that would actually carry gold bricks in the pockets. I mean, that would be very tiresome.
Yeah.
So I can understand why we would actually have either checks, personal types of check system, to allow people to write a check for the amount that they need to pay somebody, you know, because it could be a couple of gold bricks. a person could easily walk in and say, I want to buy this, you know, your property. I want to spend a lot of money, and allow a personal check to basically be utilized to transfer a set amount of currency from your bank account to their bank account. Now, back in those days, you know, it was difficult, but at least they could kind of do it. It was not in the realms of impossible, like digital currency. It wasn't the technology that just made it impossible. But the point is that when we look at the concept of having a cash, in other words, for a person to walk around outside of having a check in managing deposits and withdrawals and those types of transactions, because that's all a check is, allowing you to do that. That doesn't mean that that's considered a legal tender for the payment of debt. It is just a legal contract that when you're basically transferring money from your account to another account, you're obligating that amount to be taken from you. It's not like you can obligate somebody to take money from them. It's you surrendering money. So I can understand that being outside of the currency itself. The currency itself being gold and silver, because the Constitution really demands this. And Sean, for your benefit, when we hit the ratification base, it is going to blow you away how they dove into the importance of not having scrips, not having this kind of crap, that the federal government would only have gold and silver, and why they needed to set that standard. And instantly out the gate, Hamilton starts, you know, basically preaching implied powers, and Congress had the choice to listen and follow, and the states had the choice to listen and reject, or Congress could have rejected as well. But instead, because everybody was getting something out of this, they found favor. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, that sounds like the beginning of where we got to now.
Okay, so when we look at what can the federal government do regarding currency, you know, they're supposed to have gold and silver coin, but on top of that, I think that it's within reason that they provide a commutable bill that obtains the that maintains the value of the silver dollar, gold dollar, what have you, 1 ounce of this, 5 ounces of this, whatever, so that you have these bills that you can carry that doesn't require you to actually have the gold on you. That bill is equal to the gold itself, because you can take it to any bank and turn it in and commute it for that currency. That is a sound economic system that was done, and that's what the framers gave us and created. We're out of time. But to be clear, folks, that's what they have the authority to do. Everything that we see here, everything that they did here, they didn't have the authority to do. Hamilton just bamboozled them, and because they were getting something for it, they went along with it. And it still baffles my mind why Jefferson and Madison, other than because they walked into that compromise buzzsaw, they were bound to actually have to obligate to meet this. This is why we go through these details. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.